Welcome to the Leadership Journey Podcast. My name is Alan Wilson. I'm the host of the podcast. Each week we give you the opportunity to reflect on some of the things that make up a leadership journey. And this week I'm speaking once again to Jonathan Ray of New Irish Arts. Jonathan, welcome back to the Leadership Journey Podcast. And we have been talking about your emergence into the role, really, of this title, this remarkable title, which I don't know how many people have, the Creative Director of New Irish Arts. In fact, we didn't quite get you there. We left the story in the previous podcast where you'd been entrusted with by Keith Getty to pick up the thing and run with it. But the becoming the full-time creative director, that's something that's happened much later, isn't it?
Yes.
Or much more recently.
For about 5 or 6 years, I continued to teach alongside New Irish.
Yeah.
And we were doing a number, usually one event per month,
yeah,
in New Irish at the same time as I was teaching. And I guess there came a point when I realised that it was impossible to do everything,
yeah,
and put the brakes on and thought, right, I need to reflect here for a while. And I tracked the working hours I was doing, mm-hmm, and it was absurd. It was just, mm-hmm, it wasn't sustainable with family life, with health, with anything. Mm-hmm. And it was time to make changes.
Yeah.
And so I took a career break from school, first, yeah, of all, and thought, well, if I give the vast majority of my time to New Irish Arts, I think I'll be able to give that organisation greater impetus, mm-hmm, and be more effective. Mm-hmm. And that the idea, it's funny how the idea of deleting something often is the way to make things more effective. So, mm-hmm, even in music, very often when you're making an album and, mm-hmm, and there's something wrong with the sound, it's almost always putting something in the bin rather than adding something else in that makes, sure, the sound nicer.
Sure.
And for me in my life, that was a really key point. I needed to part company with the teaching job, uh-huh, in order to be properly effective in what I was going to do day by day, because, yeah, I'd reached a stage where in order to get better at either thing, something was going to have to go.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned both family and health there, and obviously that the balance, and You are a young man, and you've got family responsibilities and so on, and therefore, you know, the juggling of all of those things was a challenge. But mentioning health, it wasn't too long after you moved into this role full time that you had quite a serious health issue.
That's right. I hosted my wife's 40th birthday party one night and went away in an ambulance the following night, sure, most unexpectedly.
It wasn't at the impact of your wife turning 40.
No, it wasn't. I will say I was only 38 at the time. But I went off in an ambulance because I had pancreatitis, and my pancreas had decided to attack all the other organs in my body at one go. And I had an acute episode of that, which was caused by gallstone going in the wrong place. And I never knew any of the words I've just said at that point. I never heard of pancreatitis. But I knew that I was in trouble.
You thought it was a railway station in London?
I had no idea. And so for about 6 months, I was pretty much limited to doing very well. I was very ill for 3 months, and then there was maybe a further 6 months.
How long were you in hospital?
In and out over a period of 2.5 months.
Yeah. And for those, I mean, for people not medical, it is an extremely serious condition.
It's a very painful condition, and there are people who die from it. Mm. And so, essentially, overnight, my sense of invincibility went.
Your sense of invincibility went?
I think we go, okay, through life believing, yeah, that we're all okay.
Yeah.
You know, and you hear things that happen to other people, but then it actually takes something to happen to you that puts the pause button on, mm-hmm, that makes you think, hold on.
Yeah.
I'm not here forever.
Yeah.
And at that stage, my wife was 5 months pregnant with our third child. Mm-hmm. And there was, I suppose, there's a reduction that happens in your head when you understand, here are the things that really, really matter to me.
Yeah.
Matter to me. The illness had various complications along the way. Some people have that. If you've just been diagnosed with pancreatitis and you're listening to this, it might be okay within a few weeks. Mine got a little more complicated than it should have done. I was left type 1 diabetic. Mm-hmm. And the effect of that on me personally has been that my stamina is different, mm-hmm, from how it was the day, mm-hmm, before all that, mm-hmm, happened. And I'm still insulin dependent and so on, and that has to be managed. And it's a bit of a roller coaster all the, mm-hmm, time, no matter how well you can control it. It's a thing you can't ignore. You can never take a day off being diabetic.
Yeah.
And so sometimes that kills my energy in a way that is frustrating and a bit limiting. And trying to keep the public row running as well as you can while at the same time fighting something like that in private has been a big challenge over the last few years. And by God's grace, it's happening, and I have much to be thankful for. I'm still here, others in the circumstances might not have been. And you know, our little boy is 4.5 now, and yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to be thankful for.
I found it very interesting what you say about the loss of your sense of invincibility. I know when I was pretty much the same age, I went through heart surgery, and there is something about realizing the fragility of life.
I think the suddenness is the thing that stuns us. Because literally, I'd spent the previous week in meetings organising what I was going to do for the next 6 months, because that's what you do in January. And we were due to start recording an album within 2 or 3 days of when I went into the hospital, and it was all the carpet was underneath me. That was quite a powerful thing, because you tend to proceed through your life as though your plans are going to work.
Do you find that? I mean, we're 5 years on now, right? Yeah. Do you find that? Are you still as aware of that vulnerability now, or are? It's not that you've kind of defaulted to.
No, I think you can't allow it to debilitate you day by day. If you did, you would get nowhere. But you've got to live with a sense that you're not here forever. And that helps you to focus and prioritize. It helps you to appreciate things that are going on in other people's lives. I mean, more sensitive.
How would you say it affected your faith? Well, I think what you've put your finger on is already a massive lesson, a massive life lesson.
I have long believed that the power of learning lyrics of songs is very great.
Yeah.
People don't tend to memorise stuff in as intentional a way as they would have done a generation ago when we all were, given a lollipop each week for learning the Bible verse, coming back to Sunday school. That style of thing is much less done, even in schools. People don't rote learn and so on anymore. So memorisation is a different thing. However, we all still know the lyrics of songs. And what was interesting for me was that in the darkest nights of not being able to sleep because I was in agony and I was in hospital, lyrics that were far in the depth of my memory came back to me, and the songs went around my head and some of the dark places, and some horrendous music went around my head as well, which was crazy noises and so on, due to the drugs I was on. But in the middle of it all, in the dark places, there were lyrics, including even lyrics that I had written, where God was speaking, actually. And there was a song I had written less than a year before it all happened called Why Should I Fear, which I thought I understood when the day I wrote it, and I understood it a year later a whole lot better. Just about the assurance of God's presence in difficult situations. And I could never have anticipated that I was going to look at the lyric in a completely different way a year down the line.
I'm going to take us on a little digression here, and we can come back to those lyrics in a moment. But I think since you've mentioned the power of those lyrics coming back, I think at the risk of sounding like an old man, and I know it's not just old men who say this, but the whole issue of what we sing, as Christians, what we sing. Are we singing stuff? I mean, I'll tease out your view on this, but are we singing stuff that actually is not really going to have the ability to sustain us in the kind of crisis that you're talking about? Or how important is it to really sing? How important is it to sing material that is going to serve us well, whatever experiences we may go through in life?
I think there's multiple layers, and you can answer that question in a podcast all by itself. Have a shot at being concise.
If there's a lot to say, we can have another podcast on it.
I think the situation is much better than it was a relatively short time ago. I think the modern hymn movement has encouraged a lot of people to sing theology and to understand their faith better as they sing. I think at the same time there's an understanding that emotional engagement isn't all bad. So it's important for us to sing truth. It's important for us to sing reality. And occasionally my job now, and part of what we do in New Irish, is to help train people in churches to think about how we do music in church. One of the things I talk about is when you're choosing the material for a congregation to sing, you want to make sure that the diet is as broad and balanced as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And churches which only sing emotional about how I feel today will lack an understanding of why they feel how they feel.
Mm-hmm.
Churches that only sing theology will sometimes risk the possibility of only having a head faith.
Yeah.
And reflecting the whole gamut of Christian experience is a very important part of how we sing together.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to be able to sing that the Lord is good and the Lord is enduring and that His love endures forever. We also want to be able to sing that we love Him and thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important that we feed both of those things into mm-hmm. to what people sing when they're together.
Do you think, we're really in a digression now, it is my fault, but do you think that there's a conversation that is not happening between various musical brands within the church? Do you think there's one, you know, maybe a section of the church that's writing stuff that's much more feelings driven, and there's another section of the church that's wanting to sing and write material that's theologically driven? Are they talking to each other?
Rather than talking about that specifically, what I will say is that when I try to train church groups or leaders to think about where they get songs from, I'm encouraging them to go to all the places where they can. So I will spend 5 or 6 days a year
mm-hmm.
just listening to songs on Spotify or something like that, one after the other, and waiting for the things that draw me in from lots of sources where I would never bother to buy the album.
Yeah.
And I sit and I listen, and you know, out of most camps mm-hmm. there is something each year that is worth looking at.
Yeah.
And that is irrespective of the theological stance of where they're coming from, because mm-hmm. There have been songs that have come from people with whom I would have minimal agreement
mm-hmm.
on many big important issues, but their expression of one particular truth on one particular day is very helpful to me.
What are you looking for then when you listen to that selection of music? What jumps out for you?
Because I'm thinking very often of things that will work congregationally when I'm doing that particular job. I'm looking for stuff that's going to have a singable melody that's going to work easily for a congregation, because I believe that the singing congregation is the powerful vehicle by which those lyrics get learnt, rather than the situation where the congregation sits halfway down the church with the band on stage enjoying their new song. punctuate that sentence as you will. But the idea that the congregation is the singing vehicle is important, and so I'm looking for something that's singable. I'm also looking for something that's beautiful, that actually draws me in emotionally and makes me think this is a good thing, and I'm looking for something that's theologically true
mm-hmm.
and useful to sing, and also thematically helpful, I mm-hmm. guess. I encourage people when they think about songs not to look at songs in isolation, mm-hmm. but to take almost like a zoom lens approach to the whole thing, so they come at it thinking about a big strategy for their church mm-hmm. or whatever group they're working with. So you think about how many songs can my church learn in the 6-month period mm-hmm. and what are the best ones for us to do.
Mm-hmm.
When I come to think about the songs for a particular service, again, you take a high level view and look at is it better for me to just look at that song and then that song and that song, or am I looking at what makes a good set together
mm-hmm.
in the 15 minutes that we might sing songs in a row for?
Yeah.
Things like that. And I think that allows you sometimes to sing a song which doesn't say very much by itself, but in the context of what's going on around it, says quite a great deal.
Yeah.
And actually also going way back to the heritage that I have from very conservative churches, I have a personal interest and passion for some of the old Victorian hymns, which I think occupy a very interesting space in this, because they have lyrics which are more emotionally connected but within the structure of a hymn. And I'm thinking about things like Love with Everlasting Love, Led by Grace That Love to Know, which talks about heaven above is softer blue, softer blue, earth around sweeter green when we know the Lord.
Yeah.
And the whole idea that the poetry is instantly understandable, yeah, but still in its own intimate way quite beautiful. But yeah, if you do six of those in a row, then you've yeah, killed the yeah, thing. But something like that dropped into the flow
yeah,
of an otherwise all theological or all emotional thing. It's about mix and matching in those things, yeah, so that the diet is balanced.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe there's an idea for a future podcast, you know, with a bunch of people who lead the musical worship in churches. We could have a little round table or something like that. That would be fascinating. We could come back to your own story, though. We got onto that because we were talking about the power of lyrics that you had.
Yes,
in the darkness. They kind of came back, yes, into the forefront of your mind. Were there other ways that your relationship with God changed as a result of what you went through?
The whole thing was quite a bittersweet experience in many ways, because it came at quite a traumatic period in our lives together as a couple, in that my wife's mum had passed away the year before, and my father actually passed away the year afterwards. So 3 winters in a row we had trauma, and the third baby in the middle of it as well. So it was a tricky enough period in our lives, and there was an extent to which I was frustrated at God for throwing all this at us at once. And I have to be honest about that. But at the same time, I also became aware that there were lessons to learn in that space, and that God was carrying me through it. And I had an awareness that in the middle of it all, my mother actually talked to me about at one stage when I was feeling very, very low. She said, "You have to look for the mercy." And I find that very powerful, because my mother has never invaded my spiritual life ever.
Mm-hmm.
She's been gentle all the way.
Mm-hmm.
And that day she spoke with an authority that was from God.
Mm-hmm.
I'm absolutely convinced.
You have to look for the mercy.
Look for the mercy, she said. Mm-hmm. And in the middle of it all, I began to see God's hand in the whole thing, not just measurable in human terms like my recovery, but actually in terms of the shaping of me and the refining of my character. And I began to understand that it was going to make me more sympathetic to other people, because that wouldn't have been a strong point before all this happened. And I think probably in the middle of it all, it helped me to understand that God was faithful, and actually that God would be faithful even if I didn't survive. I remember staring that idea in the face at one stage, and coming out of that, I guess you reach a point where you realise that everything that you thought you had lined up in a row isn't just quite as neat as you thought, and accepting that is part of accepting the mystery of God's plan. I think for me that's the period of time when that began to really bed down as an idea for me.
Has that fed into your actual leadership then, the way you lead the organisation, how you think about leadership?
I lead an organisation which relies entirely on the willingness of its volunteers to arrive and do things, and on the willingness of audiences to come and spend time listening to what we do.
And spend some money to do it as well.
Yes, indeed. And so you have to care about people. You have to put yourself into the position of others. And you have to... The day you stop listening to the ones who volunteer to work alongside you is a bad day, because then the job disappears, slowly. And I guess my awareness of that aspect of having to lead in a way which is empathetic is much stronger. I am by nature a control freak. I want to plan everything. You know, I live lots of my life through carefully planned Excel spreadsheets of what I'm going to do when, and timings and structures and all the rest. I like it when it all goes click, 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 boom. And I had to embrace the idea that life wasn't going to be like that for a while. And learn to give some of my responsibility away, which was, I think, probably the first time I'd really engaged with that idea properly. And I think for others, there's benefit to be gained when we let go of things that we have held too tightly.
Yeah, I think it's one of the counterintuitive learnings about leadership, isn't it? That we the more we hold on to the power or the degree of influence that we have. In a way, we actually limit our influence. And the more we're ready to empower other people, the more we extend our influence.
Yes, if at the one time, I guess I came to the position where I realised that at the one time we were investing huge resource and time into having a youth choir to try and future-proof our organisation. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I was holding on to the reins of everything so tightly that it was actually debilitating the possibility of it having a future.
Right.
And so you learn to let go just a little bit more and be a little bit more willing to go with the ebb and flow of what happens around you. Mm-hmm. And that's probably one of the strongest take-homes I've had after the period of illness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I suppose, you know, in leadership, there's that... The importance of having an eye for the detail, and you're leading an organisation, and there's that the whole artistic thing. You've got to have an eye for detail. You've got to know what the guy with the triangle in the back. You know, you've got to know what he's doing and what he adds and all of that. So there's detail there, but yet an eye for detail. Did you say control freak?
Yeah, I did.
You know,
yeah.
You used the term yourself. You know, an eye for detail. Can become that debilitating thing as well.
How do you
what would you say would be your strengths and weaknesses around those themes, and maybe some of the other themes in the way that you lead?
Still learning. I think one of the things for me that I enjoy is the process of putting together an event, mm-hmm. and I like to do that absolutely alone. I like to sit for a day and craft the thing without interruption. And so when I'm put into a committee to plan through an event, I find that slows down the process of creativity for me. But sometimes you end up with something better when you get the synergy of people working together, yeah. You know, where 1 + 1 = more than 2.
Yeah.
And I have been reluctant to accept that over the years. Yeah. I say that I think that's still a weakness, to be brutally honest, if I'm truthful about it. I try and invite ideas more frequently, but I still like to go into my room on my own and suss out which ones are going to find their way to the top of the pile and which ones are going to be discarded. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's still an area of growth there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, generally speaking, though, do you have a good awareness of what makes you a good leader? Do you have an awareness of the things that would, you know, potentially hinder your leadership?
I think one of the things I'm aware of that might potentially hinder my leadership is that when people say to you that thing where they say, where would you like to be in 5 years' time? I never have an answer for that. I've never been a strategic thinker in that way who's come up with a big plan for the rest of. And curiously, if I had come up with a big plan 10 years ago, you know, it would have had a whopping big undermining thing in the middle of it. I think God has been gracious to me in that I have followed one step at a time to the point where I'm at now, waiting for things that he has placed in front of me, and I have never woken up in the morning wondering what I'm going to do that day. Mm-hmm. And that's because I believe he's placed opportunities in front of me. I mean, one of the things that has been a big surprise over the last couple of years has been that I stuck my nose randomly into a conversation one day with a BBC producer when I was involved in doing music for a broadcast, and I was talking about the script just casually, and suddenly I was invited to do a thought for the day. And last year I did more religious broadcasting that had nothing to do with music, and if I had ever designed a plan for my development, it would never have included that. And yet God has placed that opportunity on my lap now, and it has become a really rewarding way of exercising a completely different part of my brain.
Right, so you're talking about the little thought for the day slot, which you've done on Radio 4, haven't you?
There's a prayer for the day on Radio 4. It happens very early in the morning, yes, which I've done a few times. Yeah. And I've done a few services for Radio Ulster as well.
Yeah.
And that's a completely different way of approach. The vision is still the same.
Yeah.
I'm still trying to point people towards God.
Yeah.
But to do it through speech rather than music is an interesting discipline.
Yeah.
And I find that a really rewarding thing, but I would never have strategized that into my plan for myself. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm saying is God has been gracious in opening doors for me along the way that I would never have pushed. Mm-hmm. Now, that means that I have to, in the conversations with leaders, when you go, well, what are you planning next? Sometimes I have to say, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Which sounds like the wrong answer.
It sounds like the wrong answer, but for me, it has actually turned out to be the right answer.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes our obsession with long term planning and goal setting, it's part of the prevailing culture. I think there's a counter cultural approach to leadership, which can sometimes be actually beneficial.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I suppose people are concerned that that leaders don't just drift.
Yes,
that's the other danger, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. And do the same thing time and time again, because that's a big temptation. And I thought when I was leaving teaching that I was moving out of a structure which went year on year on year, but actually every organisation
Christmas
finds
comes
its
around.
Own,
yeah.
Every organisation finds its rhythm.
Yeah.
And so it's important that we don't get stuck in ruts.
Yeah.
Yes, you're right. And you've got to be responsive and bold and willing to do things that are slightly outside your comfort zone. In terms of the strength, I think I go back again to the business about knowing that you have volunteers and understanding people. Mm-hmm. And curiously, one of the things that's developed, again, organically, has been a greater degree of pastoral interest in people. Mm-hmm. And I guess we have people who come and participate in the Irish Arts who maybe find local church quite difficult. Mm-hmm. They're maybe involved in so much music that they don't have time to get involved in a local church ministry, or their faith is perhaps at a point when it's hanging on the edge a wee bit. And I want to create a space where those people feel comfortable expressing whatever their faith is in action and working at that time. And so I think probably I've learned to have more of a heart for people and what's going on in their lives than I have for the possibility of a 5-year plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's an interesting dimension to your work in leading New Irish Arts. And again, obviously people who have some familiarity with the organisation, they see the public events and they see your role in the public events, but they're not necessarily going to think, what you're describing is it's an organisation that's also a community. And then I suppose to some extent you have a pastoral role. You're a pastoral leader to those people.
But we've got to have an awareness that we're not functioning as a church either.
If you're someone who's not practicing their music or not turning up, on time and so on, whatever pastoral responsibilities you might have, you're still going to make the orchestra work, right?
Yeah, you've got to make it happen.
Yeah. Is it a challenge to keep those things together, where you're calling people to a standard of excellence, but yet you're trying to recognise that sometimes there are things that are going on in their lives that just mean that, you've got to be very gentle with them?
I think a lot of the guys who play and sing for us are doing their natural thing.
Yeah.
And I think what I'm trying to do is to open the gate for them to do their natural thing. So it's not the business about calling them to excellence.
Yeah.
There's an extent to which that's true, but there's also an extent to which I feel very, very privileged to work alongside all these talented people.
Because the excellence is built in.
Yes, the excellence happens.
Yeah.
Because, and that's a thing I feel very, very fortunate to interact with and to lead, because you've got to not get... It's important that I don't forget that there are people in there who are as talented as I am doing what they're doing. Yeah. I just happen to be at the front.
Yeah.
And it's my job to give it direction. And I guess they have to have their creative space within the whole thing as well, in terms of how they perform.
But it's almost back to that thing that I mentioned a few minutes ago, where leaders are giving away power, they're empowering other people, and your task is to, you've got these talented people who are going to rise to a great level of excellence, and your responsibility is just to free them to do that. Let's go back a little bit here. Just you talked about the opportunities with radio and so on. There are other opportunities that you've got, influencing opportunities, I would call them, where you're doing seminars, churches are asking you to speak. What does that all look like?
I think much of that is about trying to root what we do in the big concerts to a direction where it's helpful and grassroots church.
Yeah.
So we recognise that we have luxury, Marks and Spencer's finest, or whatever, branded music, whatever, that when people come to a concert, then they're coming to something that's very special.
Yeah.
How do we use the resource that's present on the stage to then help people who are dealing with normal volunteers?
And we'll not attach any supermarket names to
St. Aldi's Church, whatever, St. Little's, St. Normal Church.
Yeah.
And I guess one of the things we try to do is to put a wee bit more resource into trying to shape that sort of thing and bring the expertise that we have, because we're fortunate enough to do what we do in music, and try and help people in ways that are simple, in terms of not just music but communication and, you know, forming communities within their bands and and that sort of thing, because a huge number of the issues around music and local church are relational. And I think there's an important space to be in there. So yes, I've been speaking to churches and things like that and trying to help.
Does it excite you that you have the opportunity to shape what goes on so many churches in terms of the life of worship through music?
I wouldn't want to overflatter the power of one individual talk, because you go along and you work alongside people for a day. And like any Christian conference where you go and you hear a sort of stirring talk, there's always the wonder in the back of your head of how much that actually changes people's lives on a work a day thing. And I would love to be able to measure that in some way, but it's very difficult to do that. So yes, the thought of being able to be part of the conversation that shapes a group or a bunch of people end up doing a thing in a way which is more helpful to their congregation, that's a good thing to do. But I guess one of the things I'm very aware of is that until I go to heaven, I'm not going to know the fruits of much of what we do, because we're not in the. I mean, Billy Graham has just passed away a couple of weeks ago, and there are numbers associated with the Billy Graham ministry of people who have come to Christ or have heard the gospel under his preaching. And in our case, we are a step back from that, in that we're trying to provide a bridge that will take people and, in a fairly generic way, point them towards God. And we're the little strap line we use quite frequently is we encourage people to worship God, and we're thinking there about the idea that whether you're someone who's been a Christian for 45 years, you can come to our event and you'll be encouraged to worship God at it. But equally, if you're someone who has never encountered God at all, you can walk through the door and be encouraged to worship God at the event. And I've always been excited about those two things happening in one place at the same time. And so for me, anything that feeds into that vision is worth doing. And whether that's coming on one day and speaking to church in the hope that you'll do something that helps their band get better, so that people are more encouraged to worship God without distractions of stupid stuff that happens in church bands, or whether it's a case of you putting on a big public waterfront concert, or whether you're taking 100 young people away for a week, it's all about having that one vision that it's about encouraging people to worship God. And so that for me is what it's about, and whatever I can do along the way to do it is time well spent.
Okay, listen, time's almost gone here, and there are really a couple of things that I want to ask you. One of them I'm probably going to have to. We did say in the first podcast that we would explore a little bit more the whole area of Christians and the arts. That's going to be something that's going to have to. We're going to kick that one down the road a little bit and get someone like Ross Wilson, the artist, to come in, and the pair of you can sit and we'll have a conversation about that. But just maybe finally, let's do
one sentence on which is great. The whole idea of the understanding. I don't think we touched on this before. The whole idea of the understanding of God as creator and filtering that down into humans. You know, I remember reading once that God create. God's the only one who creates, and we you know, we modify and we do things too, but actually we don't originate anything. And there's an extent to which that's true. Our creativity depends on the creativity of the creator. Our source of beauty is the beautiful creator. Our anything that we do that appears to be glorious must first point towards the glorious one. And I guess the whole idea of God being the creator, and how we use the creativity he has given us, that to me is a very natural connection. And so for anyone who is suspicious of the idea that creativity is something that's worth using as part of the gospel, I think it absolutely is. But you've also got to be rooted in the truths of the gospel and tie those two things together, because if it's vague creativity just for the purpose of just to be pointing to something nice, then it has the ability to generate some sort of pseudo spiritual experience in people and an emotional response. But you've got, for me, you've got to be explicit about what you're linking it to and the God that we're pointing to. And that's a very important part of how arts and Christianity must work together. If it's art that's just beautiful but it's too vague for people to get it, then for me that's not the space I want to be in. For me, I want to make sure that the connection is explicit and vivid.
Okay, yeah. It's interesting that, you know, just as you said that, I'm thinking that in the Old Testament, I think it's the first reference to anyone being filled with the Spirit. It's the men who were given the artistic ability to design the elements that would make up the tabernacle. Bezalel was one mentioned, I think, in Leviticus. But the Spirit
just
of God,
Bible Trivial Pursuit.
the you know, the significance of the fact that the first mention of being filled with the Spirit is actually associated with artistic creativity in
that,
the service of, in the service of God. I can't think of the reference just off the top of my head. I'll do that when the podcast is finished. Final question: as you think about your own leadership, think about your leadership in your Irish arts. Do you have any ambitions for it, or is it more what we talked about 10 minutes ago, let's see what God does? Do you have things that you'd like to see develop?
It is definitely more, let's see what God does.
Yeah.
There are ideas that come in my head sometimes that I wonder will work practically. I would love to see a network of similar organisations around the world, mm-hmm. Supporting each other and sharing resources and sharing ideas and expertise. I would love to see that develop, and I wonder sometimes, we are actually fairly large in terms of this type of organisation in different places in the world, and I wonder sometimes whether we might kickstart that someday. But at the minute, there's enough on our doorstep, mm-hmm. to fill the available time, mm-hmm. and God keeps opening the doors, and at the day when it's time to do whatever, I guess, makes our vision maybe a little bit more global, mm-hmm. When it's time to do that, we will know.
Yeah. Excellent. Jonathan Ray, thank you very much indeed. Appreciate your time. It's been fascinating to talk about these things. And God bless you in what you're doing.
Thank you, Alan.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to this episode of the Leadership Journey podcast. If you'd like to know more about the work that Jonathan is involved in with New Irish Arts, you can find them online at newirisharts.com. And I'm sure you can get in touch with Jonathan there if you've got any questions, anything you'd like to follow up in terms of some of the things that he's been talking about. Hope you have a good week. Again, thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next week.